Have you ever gone through a paradigm shift? Stephen Covey, the author of 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, defines a paradigm shift like this. Belief is another word for paradigm. It's a synonym, your belief of the way things are. We all have many beliefs when it comes to teaching practices. These beliefs come from the training we've received, our colleagues, what leaders at our school prioritize, the books we've read, and the experiences we've had in the classroom. Early in my teaching career, I began to believe in the importance of student engagement and planning lessons that were meaningful and relevant to the real world. Reading and writing workshop methods seemed to fit perfectly with these beliefs and maybe even are the root of those beliefs. I've been all for what's termed a student-centered classroom, where the ultimate goal is for students to become independent readers and writers, and the teacher's role is to facilitate the discovery of a love of reading and writing and take that love into their lives outside of the classroom. Recently, though, I've taken upon myself to read books that rely heavily on recent studies about the most effective teaching practices for improving the learning of students who are underserved, students who live in poverty, students of color, students with special learning needs. What I've found has caused many huge paradigm shifts and belief shifts when it comes to what's best for students. In this episode, I'll discuss 5 of those main paradigm shifts that I've experienced and the books that have caused these shifts. I'll also discuss how I'm reconciling the new teaching methods I'm learning, which really aren't that new, honestly, with my love of workshop methods. Welcome to the Workshop Teacher Podcast, a podcast for teachers who are interested in trying workshop in their classrooms and teachers who are obsessed with it, like me. This episode is brought to you by Workshop Teacher School. Teachers waste hundreds of hours trying to develop lesson plans themselves. Look, you don't have to anymore. I have done all of the work for you. I've developed a year's worth of units and mini lessons that you can use to teach reading and writing workshop to your middle school students. These mini lessons are very simple, but also super engaging. I've also gone through the entire year's worth of curriculum with the lens of social justice, and I believe that my units are equitable and also support you in meeting the needs of your diverse students. All of my lessons include tips on conferring and different ways that you can support different students in your classroom, support for struggling writers and readers, and opportunities for you to edit a lot of the materials. So if you want to learn more about my membership program, Workshop Teacher Membership and Workshop Teacher School, go to amandarightnow.com, and on the homepage, there's a Learn More button. Click that and you'll be directed to a page that has all the information that you need. As I begin this episode, I want you to please try to be open. Covey says it best. The more aware we are of our basic paradigms, maps, or assumptions, and the extent to which we have been influenced by our experience, the more we can take responsibility for those paradigms, examine them, test them against reality, listen to others, and be open to their perceptions, thereby getting a larger picture and a far more objective view. I love that. All right, let's get started. The first paradigm shift that I'm going to talk about, number one, is that lessons that impact student achievement have just these 6 parts, just 6 parts. And the book that's influenced this paradigm shift is a book called Focus, Elevating the Essentials to Radically Improve Student Learning by Mike Schmoker. Schmoker describes the parts of a lesson that have the biggest impact on student outcomes and achievement. These six lesson parts aren't anything new or trendy. They are tried and true classics. We've all learned about it at some point or another in our teaching careers. When teachers utilize these lesson parts, they have tremendous success in a wide range of school settings when it comes to impacting student achievement. The book Focus has all sorts of stories and statistics proving it, and research. So here are the six lesson parts. Number one, learning objective. State what students will learn in specific kid-friendly language. Number two, anticipatory set. Connect with what students already know or are interested in. Number three, teach and model. Teach the skill by modeling it in front of students. Number four, guided practice. Give students time to practice the skill as the teacher observes. Number five, check for understanding. Assist students' abilities by cold calling, choosing students at random, not by raise of hands. Having students show whiteboards or speak with a partner and listen in on what they're talking about. And then number six, adjust or reteach. Repeat the process if you observe students need it. That's it. Those are the six parts of an effective lesson. And there's lots of study and research that's been done to show how effective these six parts are. So how does this impact the workshop model? Well, I feel like, in my opinion, the workshop model does a really good job of the first three parts, the objective, anticipatory set, and in my curriculum, I call it a hook, and the teaching and modeling. Now, what about four through six, the guided practice, the checking for understanding, the adjusting, and the research? I think the workshop model is lacking in those aspects of an effective lesson. So what are we to do? Here's an idea that might be really controversial. Stop conferring and do more guided practice as a whole class. Oh my goodness. Okay, so I'm going to discuss more about this in paradigm shift number three. So stay tuned. Let's talk about paradigm shift number two first. So paradigm shift number two is that direct instruction is one of the most effective teaching strategies. After reading Seven Myths of Education by Daisy Christodoulou, my entire teaching philosophy and the foundations I have as a teacher were put into question. I had many paradigm shifts while reading this book, and I recommend all teachers read it. The most shocking thing I read was how impactful direct instruction is on student achievement and how educators are encouraged not to talk so much. I mean, we've all heard the saying, and I've even used the saying, the one doing the talking is doing the learning. Or how about this one? Don't be the sage on the stage. We have made direct instruction taboo, and I have direct experience with this. So why are we as educators encouraged to talk less? Because students have short attention spans and will become disengaged after a while. But Christodoulou, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, Christodoulou, I don't know, I think that's how you pronounce it, makes the important point that the solution to poor exposition, which she means direct instruction, is better teacher exposition, not the complete absence of teacher exposition. She cites studies done by respected researcher and educational theorist John Hattie in his book, Visible Learning, a synthesis of over 800 meta-analyses relating to achievement. Hattie describes the effect of direct instruction. Hattie synthesized the results of hundreds of different analyses of achievement and measured the effect of different factors. Direct instruction was the third most powerful teacher factor. The only two more powerful teacher factors were feedback, which is not opposed to direct instruction, and Indeed is a part of it, and instructional quality, which again is not opposed to direct instruction. The more I pondered this, the more I realized how indoctrinated I've become to the student-centered approach. So much so that I truly believed that talking too much was something I needed to get away from. Krista Dulow's book has helped me realize that direct instruction, when done in an engaging way, can be incredibly powerful for students. So how does this impact the workshop model? We are told by workshop gurus, and I've said this myself, that many lessons need to be short, 10 minutes or less, and that students need to spend the majority of their time reading or writing. I still believe that many lessons should be short because student attention span wanes after about 15 minutes of direct instruction. But what needs to happen after the 15 minutes of direct instruction is guided practice. And if students need it, more direct instruction in response to the observations made while students are engaged in guided practice. So again, the writing work time, the reading work time component of workshop should be more fluid, with practice and direct instruction interwoven throughout the work time period. And this is just a side note that's actually not even included in this blog post, but I just want to mention that a lot of times when we feel like our students are off task, or we feel like students just can't read for long periods of time without getting distracted, or write for very long without getting distracted, I think there's a reason for that. I think it's because they need more direct instruction. They need more support. And they're communicating through their behavior that they need the support. So if you've been one of those teachers who just feels like you can't make workshop work for you, it's probably because you're making kids write for too long or read for too long, and they need your support more. Okay, let's go to paradigm shift number 3. This one's crazy, so remember, keep an open mind. Differentiation isn't that effective. Of all the paradigm shifts I've mentioned, this one, in my opinion, is the most controversial. Conferring is such a foundational element in the workshop classroom, and the main way that workshop teachers attempt to differentiate to meet the multitude of needs their students have is through conferring. Okay, so here's what Schmoker had to say in his book, Focus, Elevating the Essentials of Radically Improve Student Learning About Differentiation. This is what he says. For more than a decade, experts have pointed out that there isn't any evidence supporting this approach. As researcher Brian Goodwin writes, there is no empirical evidence for the effectiveness of this popular pedagogic fad. Not even its advocates would claim that differentiated instruction is an evidence-based practice. It's not listed anywhere as one of the top 10, 100, or even 200 proven practices. I have an opinion article linked to this blog post about differentiation. It's called Differentiation Doesn't Work. And there's a link to a counter argument by Carol Ann Tomlinson, author of many books about differentiated instruction. And it's included in this article too. So both articles are worth reading and pondering. It's important to note that those who claim differentiation is ineffective aren't claiming that teachers shouldn't provide extra support to students who need it. Rather, these educational theorists, researchers, and authors are trying to prevent teachers from, as Schmoker puts it, avoiding the trap of routinely grouping students into specious, contrived categories that make effective whole class instruction impossible. Wow. Okay, so how does this impact the workshop model? This information has a huge impact on the conferring component of the workshop method. For years, I've struggled with how to confer effectively, while also making sure students who are working independently are still productive and learning. At times, I felt it's an impossible feat. Maybe the reason I felt that way all those years is because it's the truth. Differentiation is an impossible feat that takes teachers' energy away from other important work they could be doing. So do we stop conferring? Yes and no. Those that know the workshop model think of conferring as sitting down side by side with a student to provide quick feedback on their writing, or maybe making a small group based on student need. But maybe we could start to think of it differently. Maybe conferring could look this way instead. While students are writing and reading, the teacher walks around the room, observing, talking with students, complimenting, stating out loud what she notices students doing as they practice a specific skill or concept they learned during a mini lesson, or as they engage in the writing process. The teacher might give a tip here and there, but what she's really looking for are patterns in the work students are producing. Are many students struggling with the same concept? Are some students trying an effective strategy other students in the class could benefit from hearing about? If the teacher sees a pattern in student work or student conversation, if they're talking to each other or partners, the teacher might stop everyone and provide some direct instruction to the whole class in the moment and in response to what she's observed students doing. So in a sense, I'm advocating for more whole class conferring. Interesting idea, don't you think? Okay. Paradigm shift number 4, stations, group work, and projects waste time. Oh my goodness. The knowledge gap, the hidden cause of America's broken education system and how to fix it, by Natalie Wexler, is the next book that has caused me to begin to question my current teaching practices and beliefs about what's best for students. So what is the hidden cause of our broken education system, according to Wexler? Students need knowledge, and schools, districts, and educational leaders are too caught up in fads to provide students with the knowledge they need about history, social studies, science, and current events they so desperately need in order to be successful readers and writers. I'm guessing that Wexler would also agree with Schmoker and Krista Dulo about the powerful impact of direct instruction when she says, studies extending back at least 30 years have found that low-income students and any novice learners generally do best when they receive direct instruction. Stations, group work, and projects are just a few of the fads brought up in the book. Again, I think back through my 13 years as a teacher and realize the most stressful times in my career were when I was managing stations, projects, and group work. Why were these experiences so stressful? Because students were off task, and I worried, there were definitely students off task, and I worried we were wasting precious time that could be used to help these frequently off task students to grow. Here's more of what Wexler has to say about group work. Group work, which has become almost mandatory at all grade levels, often devolves into students chatting about whatever strikes their fancies, with the more conscientious group members doing all the work. We know this is true. I have to agree that this is quite often what happens when I initiate group work in my classroom. So what are we to do? Throw these teaching practices out the window? Well, again, yes and no. How does this impact the workshop model? Stations, group work, and projects aren't really huge features of the workshop model. However, I do think that this information does have an impact on how we go about organizing writing partnerships and supporting students in working with a partner during the editing and revision process. When we organize groups, I believe pairs are most effective. Students who work in pairs are more accountable and find it harder to evade work. When teaching revision and editing skills, the teacher can model revising and editing a sentence. Next, pairs can practice revising and editing a sentence from their partner's writing piece. Then pairs can compare work and get feedback from each other. This is just one example of how explicit direct instruction followed by guided practice can be done in a workshop classroom. I also believe that stations are an engaging form of guided practice. For example, after a week of mini lessons, students can rotate through stations, having them practice the skills they learned during that week's mini lesson. As students rotate through stations, the teacher can roam the room, observing how students are doing with the skills and decide if any mini lessons need to be retaught. What about projects? Daisy Christodoulou describes a test we need to give ourselves when deciding which projects we want students to engage in. What will your project make students think most about? She references Daniel Willingham's book, Why Don't Students Like School? Here's what she says. Because of the importance of long-term memory, Willingham goes so far as to say that the most general and useful idea that cognitive psychology can offer teachers is to review each lesson plan in terms of what the student is likely to think about. Projects, stations, and group work don't have to go, but these methods of teachings do need to be reconsidered and reconfigured so that we are taking into account the research about what's best for student learning. So if you're thinking about doing a project, what are students going to be thinking most about during that project? Are they going to be thinking about cutting things out? Are they going to be thinking about trying to Google things? And so just really being mindful about that. Okay, paradigm shift number 5. Reading and writing a lot won't make students better readers and writers. This was the hardest paradigm shift for me. I've always used this analogy with students and teachers who follow me. Piano players don't get better by listening to the teacher talk or looking at YouTube tutorials. They get better by playing, and it's the same thing with reading and writing. I'm seriously reconsidering this idea. Both Wechsler and Christodoulou discuss a famous experiment that was done in 1987 in which students of all reading levels were given a passage to read that was about baseball, and then a quiz to test their comprehension of the passage. You can read more about it on this blog post. I linked it. It's called The Baseball Experiment. The students who did best on the quiz weren't necessarily the strong readers. The students who did best were the ones who already had a lot of background knowledge about baseball to begin with. Reading ability had no impact on how well students were able to understand the passage. However, background knowledge was essential. Students come to our classrooms with information already stored in long-term memory. However, students who come from a more impoverished background might come with less in their long-term memory because of a lack of books in their home, less conversations with parents who are working odd hours, and less travel experience. Students who come from higher socioeconomic backgrounds might come with knowledge about a wide variety of subjects because their parents can afford to pay for special classes, tutoring, travel, books, and more. All of this is to say we need to be prioritizing knowledge in our classrooms. Our students need it to be successful readers and writers. We can't just expect that because students are doing a lot of reading and writing in our classrooms, that students will be successful with reading and writing. And I made that assumption for years. Here's what Wechsler has to say. All of this means that simply writing and possibly making the same mistakes over and over isn't likely to help struggling students. Teachers need to break down the components of the process into manageable chunks and guide students through practicing those chunks in a logical sequence while providing prompt feedback to students. This is that guided practice part. So how does this impact the workshop model? This paradigm shift has helped me realize that students need explicit, direct instruction when it comes to writing, and they need appropriate background knowledge and vocabulary to comprehend a text. They need writing mini lessons about how to construct an effective sentence, plan with an outline, add details with appositives and commas, write a hook, and construct a 5-paragraph essay. They need reading mini lessons about close reading techniques, annotation, and writing about what they read. This is just to name a few mini lesson topic ideas. Natalie Wexler has another book called The Writing Revolution that offers very specific ideas about how to go about teaching writing more explicitly. Also, a book called Reading Reconsidered, A Practical Guide to Rigorous Literacy Instruction describes what students desperately need from educators when it comes to reading. Exposure to more challenging texts with the guidance of a teacher, close reading strategies, and opportunities to write about what they read. Above all, we need to stop assuming that just because we're giving students time to read and write in class, that they're going to improve their reading and writing skills. We need to be explicit in the skills we teach and aware of the evidence from research about what advances student achievement. I've also linked a past blog post with 5 mini lessons to teach writing explicitly to support struggling writers. You'll definitely want to check that out too if you're interested in mini lessons that teach writing more explicitly. And I even provide a free slideshow with all the mini lessons on my website in that blog post. Okay, let's wrap up here. Paradigm shifts are powerful and can lead to positive growth and change. In order for a paradigm shift to occur, though, we must remain open to new ideas and find ways to reconcile what we knew before with our new knowledge. Hopefully, this episode has caused some paradigm shifts for you, and now you feel armed with information and tools you need to begin empowering your students to succeed in your English classroom and beyond. If you need more information, I always do, then you'll definitely want to check out these paradigm shift inducing books on this blog post. I link all of them there. Okay, until next time, I'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening.